I'm going to start by talking a little bit about how I came to write this book and why I focused on the media, and then also give you an overview of how I believe the torture scandal fits into the general picture of what's happening in America today. The book itself deals with all those aspects. It's not just a media analysis. It talks a lot about the ideology of torture, the language in which we justify such things, the language in which torture becomes sort of invisible. Mm-hmm. Well, I began as an activist while I was in graduate school at Johns Hopkins, principally after the first Gulf War. That was when I became very interested in the way things were portrayed, because I would go back and forth between India, which is my country of origin, and America, and I would be amazed at what I did not see on American television. I watched television at that time, very naively, for the news. I hadn't yet learned. At that time, I thought that's how you got your news. And I just saw such a discrepancy between what I was seeing abroad and what I was seeing here. My parents in India would ask me, how's that snowstorm in Baltimore? To wrap up for Sunday, the weather is going to be different. They knew everything that was happening here, because even through BBC reports, weather was, you know, channels and all that. And here, we simply don't get that. We don't get even major world-changing news from abroad. So that was when my interest in the media began, especially during the Gulf War, when things like the very famous massacre on what they call the Highway of Death, when retreating Iraqi soldiers were slaughtered, actually, in what's a very infamous turkey shoot. And that was never even discussed or known. That piqued my interest. And following that, the sanctions. While I was in graduate school, I tried to bring this up frequently in seminars, and absolutely no interest. People did not see it as genocide. They saw it as something that was Saddam Hussein's responsibility. We tried to bring in people, because Hopkins is actually the institution which put out that first report that 500,000 children were likely injured by the sanctions. And even though Hopkins had put out that report, among students and faculty, there was not that much interest. We tried to bring in activists to talk about it, I remember, as late as 98, and got no interest. And again, that was the influence of the media. If the media had been responsible, it would have given the American people that context in which to judge. And it did not give that context. There was just a blank out about Iraq. You heard about Iraq in 1989, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, 1991, after the end of the Cold War. Then the silence, as though Iraq had been solved as a problem, nothing at all. And then suddenly, 1999, you get Kosovo, it seems to be out of the blue. And because of these silences, everything always seems to come out of the blue. There's never continuity or an understanding of foreign policy in which people can place things in context and understand, well, what does this bit of news mean? And so again, my interest grew. With Yugoslavia again, I'll give you a little incident. I was actually on email with a friend in Yugoslavia while the bombing was going on, and we were watching the news reports, which were saying we are not striking apartments, civilians are not being targeted, factories, infrastructure are not being targeted, and my friend is emailing me desperately, my apartment is on fire, the factory is up there, the whole street is blazing, he actually lost his apartment, he was bombed while he was actually emailing us, a residential area. So I immediately understood that what we are getting through television is something else, it's public relations. It really is military public relations and not news at all. And then in 2003, when the drumbeat for the Iraq war began, I decided to quit my work. I was teaching at that time in the high school and become a full-time activist, first on the web petitioning and then writing. And that's how I became a freelance journalist. I felt that was the need in the country at that time. In 2004, end of April, suddenly Abu Ghraib burst onto the news. And if you all recall, it came, when did it come? What was the venue? It came through CBS, the 60 Minutes program. You suddenly saw a bunch of pictures, Arab males humiliated in various sexually explicit postures, naked. Some evidence of beating, but not extensive. Mostly it was sexual humiliation and nudity. And that burst onto our screens. It was sensational, it was titillating. People were outraged, they wanted to know why. And it was the first question that occurred to me when I saw that was, how come there are no women in this picture? We all know that probably the most the most obvious crime that takes place in war is rape, besides killing, of course, murder. The most obvious crime is rape, the rape of women, not of men usually. So it struck me as really remarkable that nobody asked that question. Nobody seemed to be interested to know. It seemed as though there was a blank on that. And I started writing a series of articles in Dissident Voice, which is an alternative newsletter, and on the absence of the story on Iraqi women. And at that time, nothing much was known. But subsequently, in the year that has followed, the reports and allegations about rape of women in prisons, rape of pregnant women, killings or deaths of women consequent to their humiliation or rape, have grown and have been substantiated. But yet, even to this day, we do not have extensive reporting in the mainstream media about the rape of women in the detention centers. We've seen a lot of talk about the men, but not about women. And that, to me, is again one of those things that need to be explained. So that's how the Abu Ghraib scandal burst into American consciousness. But anyone who had actually watched what was happening would have known that actually since 9/11, stories of torture have been in the major media. Major newspapers, including the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, even the New York Times, have reported on torture. So has The Economist, so has Nation magazine. Not extensively, but as early as December 2001, we saw pictures of torture. We saw John Lind, the American Taliban, as they called him. He was very obviously had been tortured, because we see the famous picture in the metal containers, duct taped and so on. It was clear that that was not just an unusual pose or something. Yet these stories that we saw in the media, we saw stories about a rendition, which everybody now thinks is something novel, people being taken from one country to the other to be tortured, we think that's something novel. That had been reported on again in 2001. It was reported on in 2002. So my question is, how come this only became a story last year in May? And how come it only became a story when it got onto the major media, CBS? Those are the questions that need to be asked. And it tells me that what happened was the major media came to the story only when it was impossible for them not to. And indeed, that was the case. The reason CBS actually ran that story was because Seymour Hersh had got onto it and was going to post a very lengthy article on it in The New Yorker. And they didn't want to be beaten, their ratings would, you know, they thought they were going to get good ratings with this. And so they actually sat on the story. The Pentagon asked them to sit on the story, and they did. But when Hersh looked like the story was going to go out, they went with it. But even the way it was presented tells you something about propaganda. The most titillating, but the least serious incidents. We didn't see the incidents of people being asphyxiated, drowned, burning, mock execution, real execution, sodomy, child molestation. We never saw any of those in those pictures. What we saw was Iraqi men with women's panties on their heads, which does what? It drives up ratings, it's sensational, it's titillating. At the same time, it provides a cover. And the cover is this is not serious stuff. It enables us to admit to torture, but also gives us the loophole where we can say, this is not serious. And in the context of a war where people are being bombed, the average person's response is going to be typical, which is, so what? And that's exactly how the conservative columnists responded. Rush Limbaugh famously remarked, it's like college hazing. It's no better than college hazing. And guess what? He's right. If that was all that Abu Ghraib was about, it was no more than college hazing. In fact, some college hazing in India, I know, is much worse than that. In Miranda House in Delhi, when I grew up, you had to run naked around the quad. Well-brought-up young girls had to do that. Or you were hit over the head with bricks in some other colleges. People actually die in hazing in India. So he's quite right. Of course, that doesn't mean that's not torture. It just means that getting into college is torturous. But the point is that when a story is presented like that, it's a form of propaganda. And within a week, of course, President Bush actually initially was even compelled to go to the Middle East and apologize because there was a lot of pressure, and also because abroad other photographs were coming out. The Mirror, The Independent, The Guardian, foreign newspapers were publishing much more serious reports. And under pressure of that, President Bush did go abroad and make apologies. However, At the same time, this was happening as the pressure was building up. And there were accounts and allegations that there were even more photographs available, that soldiers had taken videos and CDs of these things. Even as that was going on, the media in the U.S. was reframing the whole debate. It was reframing it as, we need to be doing this because we are dealing. This is a war, we have terrorism going on. What is the point of putting all these limits on what we can do? We'll never be able to catch terrorists in Iraq. So we'd already decided that the detentions were about terrorism, that all the people detained were terrorists, and this was a national security issue. And once it was framed like that, it was impossible to debate anymore. Once you say this is national security, it becomes impossible to debate anymore. Once you also say that mistakes were made, individuals made these mistakes, a few bad apples did this, it becomes a law and order or a crime and punishment issue. Catch the people who did the wrong, make them admit they did wrong, punish them, get rid of them, and the system works. Instead of the truth, which was that Abu Ghraib was not about individuals doing something wrong, low-level reservists like Lindy England or Charles Grainer doing something wrong, it was the official, it was the policy. I won't say it was the official policy, it was a policy that was covered up but had been put in place by the most powerful people responsible for it in the Department of Defense. And that was obvious right from the beginning. We've had confirmation through the so-called torture memos that have come out, where we found out that Justice Department legal scholars, White House legal scholars, have all been responsible for okaying certain practices which are in violation of the Geneva Conventions and of the US codes on the subject. We've seen all those torture memos now. So we know that legally, indeed, the people at the top put this policy in place. But we didn't have to wait for those torture memos. Anybody who watched and saw the Senate hearings on the subject would have known the amount of cover-up, the extent of cover-up, and the contradictions of the stories. Now let me back up a little bit and talk a little bit actually about the prison Abu Ghraib and the detention system itself. Abu Ghraib, for those of you who don't know it, was actually the prison of Saddam Hussein, in which Saddam Hussein tortured. It was notorious in Iraq. I can't think which genius came up with the idea to put Iraqi detainees there. If nothing else, it was bad karma. Anyway, they chose that. It's a prison just outside Baghdad, 24 guard cells, very bleak-looking place. I spoke to somebody who actually worked there when Saddam Hussein was in power in the 1980s. And according to he actually did not see any torture going on. He said it was quite well-furnished and people were given certain amenities. He came in during the day as a social worker and left in the evening. He described it a rather pleasant place for a prison. But of course, torture is never done in the open, usually. And indeed, torture was going on. Very barbarous punishments were going on for what the people whom Saddam Hussein considered of high value to him. And it also became very, very crowded. When the Americans overthrew Saddam Hussein, the first thing they did was to clean up this prison and actually start holding their own prisoners there. Now, since then, since the breaking of the scandal, Abu Ghraib has had its name changed. It's now Camp Redemption. I don't know if that works. But what you need to know is that initially it started out as a kind of a holding pen. They were having all these searches, kind of streets, snatches as they call them, because after the fall of Hussein and as the occupation began, they began to realize that they were not going to get this easy victory after all, that there were people resisting. The resistance grew stronger and stronger, and it was out of kind of a frustration that you couldn't find people, you couldn't get the intelligence you wanted, that people started getting swept up in a more random ways. It was almost, we have to get some information, so let's just grab everybody. And people were just rousted out of their homes, or ordinary citizens for the largest part. Arrested, transported, and they had to dump them somewhere. So they dumped them in Abu Ghraib, which is a little far, off the beaten track, just outside Baghdad. And out of that system came the first allegations of torture. And these allegations came early on. All through 2003, Amnesty International, the International Red Cross, made complaints complaints that went all the way to the top, to Condoleezza Rice, to Donald Rumsfeld, to President Bush himself. The record is there if you want to check on any of the websites, Human Rights Watch or ACLU and so on. They did send those reports, contrary to what the Department of Defense said at the time. And the allegations were of excessive force, of brutality in arrests, of lack of any kind of warrant in arrest, lack of notification, lack of legal representation, looting of money taken out without receipt, given nothing, people held for months together without being told, without any charges, and then released, dumped somewhere. And many of the practices on paper sound quite innocuous. Okay, people were flexi-cuffed with plastic cuffs. It doesn't seem very much till you realize the cuffs are so tight that actually permanent nerve damage is caused, and they're, you're held in such peculiar positions that the arms sockets are, arms are dislocated from the sockets. You're held in metal trucks and metal containers, and that doesn't sound terrible till you realize what temperatures are in Iraq, 50 degrees centigrade. So people actually have, there are descriptions of people with their backs completely burned. So then you begin to realize this is torturous. People left out in metal containers, filthy dog containers with feces and urine for days on end with one meal, limited amounts of water, isolation, held in isolation 23 hours in a day, boarded up, sensory deprivation, people who have gone psychotic, held for days. We are only beginning to see are we beginning to see the reports of the extent to which torture has taken place. But this was held in abeyance. The only reason it came out was because Joseph Darby, a particular soldier, slipped a complaint about this to his superiors, and there was a CD to match. He found a CD with some of this on it. And that is how it came about. The army investigated itself. The military started investigating itself through Major Taguba. And it was Major Taguba's report, which Hirsch chanced upon and was about to release, and that provoked CBS to do its almost a kind of an expose on one hand, but in my opinion, also a damage control expose. An expose in such a way that it minimized at the same time as titillated and sensationalized the torture. And conservatives were very quick to run with the ball on that. They were quick to say that this is, after all, Saddam Hussein tore out people's tongues, gouged out eyes, used meat grinders. How can we compare panties on people's heads with that? But of course, it wasn't panties on people's heads at all. It was also a refined form of torture, which is known as torture light, psychological torture, also known as no-touch torture. And the specific reason for the development of that type of torture, which I'll talk about in a minute, was to make it more acceptable to the public. Ostensibly, that torture is used because we want to elicit information without doing anything barbarous. That's the idea. That's the theory behind it. It was something developed under President Clinton, as a matter of fact. No-touch torture put into effect. It was actually the product of long years of research following the Second World War. Long years of research into sensory deprivation, isolation, use of stress positions to induce psychological trauma in people. And out of those years of research was produced a series of manuals, and those of you who are familiar with Central America probably are familiar with those manuals. They were the CIA manuals known as the KUBARK, K-U-B-A-R-K, developed in 1963, that was used in the training of South American intelligence agencies and turned against the populations in those countries, as a matter of fact. So-called dissidents, but more generally against the population as well. So let it not be said that this is something that developed only and solely under the Bush administration. That is the first mistake. And that is the first failure of journalism in America, has been to present it in a partisan way as something that occurred only and solely because of President Bush. Not to say that I want to diminish President Bush's responsibility in allowing the legal justification to take place. That's what exacerbated to a tremendous degree the whole problem. But truthfully, the CIA's torture has been the unofficial policy of the CIA since the 1950s. It has been funded. Research into these techniques has been funded by the government and took place at major universities. We're not talking about some sideshow somewhere. This was part of well-funded research in major universities, included some very leading figures, including Dr. Evan Cameron, who was, I think, at one time the chairman of the World Association of Psychiatrists, if I'm not mistaken, or psychologists. So this is, again, not a sideshow. And it took place systematically, was used in foreign policy as part of counterinsurgency or counter-revolutionary work in Latin America and in other areas. I'll give you an example. The photographing of prisoners naked, which is very peculiar, is very characteristic of Abu Ghraib and the detention system in Iraq, is again not new. It was used by the Shah's secret police, the SAVAK, and according to two leading journalists, people who have studied this, it was a method that the SAVAK learned from the CIA. So again, this is not a new policy. One of the things that President Clinton actually did, which has bearing on this, was that under him, when the U.S. signed the Convention on Torture in 1995, it allowed no-touch or light torture light as a kind of an exemption. Loophole was allowed to allow it to remain. And theoretically, that was because it was supposed to be more humane. But if you look, and in the book, I actually document this. If you look at Department of Defense documents, they themselves indicate that one of the reasons no-touch torture was used was because it was more acceptable to the public, and therefore it could be used more frequently. And no-touch torture goes along with such things as bloodless war, which was another kind of a notion floated in the 90s. And the whole idea, as you'll see, and I'm borrowing the phrase from Seymour Hersh, is to create gray zones in the country. A gray zone in the sense that you create a status of person, a category of person who is neither a civilian nor an enemy combatant. You create a status that is gray so that you can do things that are not legally accountable in any way. It doesn't fall into any category. And that has been the whole strategy in the development of justifications for torture under the Bush administration. And they've done it very overtly and very brazenly, but the move was begun already in the 90s under the Clinton administration. I'll give you another example of that. What's in the news right now in Europe is one aspect of the detention system, which was the rendering of prisoners. Now, the renditions actually began under President Clinton. Early renditions were done. They weren't done to the extent that they're done now. But indeed, people were moved to foreign countries with the purpose of torture, which is in violation both of U.S. and international law. How does that happen? How could it have happened? It happens because there is a loophole in the law which says that the CIA can turn over people to be tortured abroad if the CIA thinks it's plausible that they will not be tortured, if the CIA can make the argument that they really didn't know. Of course, that's a wink-wink kind of argument. And of course, the CIA did know because leading CIA officials like Vincent Canestrano are on record saying they know jolly well what was happening. They're on record. The State Department, of course, frequently criticizes countries like Egypt, Syria, and Jordan for extensive human rights violations and the practice of torture. So if the State Department is making those criticisms, how can a government at the same time claim that it doesn't know that these countries torture? Of course they do torture. And of course, in fact, in the last case, the most sensational recent case of torture, which is the Khalid al-Masri, the German citizen of Lebanese origin who was taken, just in the last few weeks we have heard of this, who was taken out of Germany. He was actually in Macedonia at the time. He was extradited. I shouldn't use the word extradited. That's a legal term. He was rendered to Egypt and tortured there. And that's the case that's now the sensation. And it's very clear that laws were broken, both United States laws and international laws. To give you some idea of the extent of the whole problem of torture, it's not just Abu Ghraib. Abu Ghraib, as I said, is one prison in Iraq. It probably held between anywhere. The numbers are all over the place, of course, but it held probably, I would say, between 8,000 to 12,000 prisoners at a given time. But it was not the only prison. we know at least of a dozen other prisons in Iraq. Some of them were converted from other buildings. Some of them were prisons themselves. Some of them were small sites. Some of them were camps. That was, say, a dozen overt prisons. We also know that there were many covert hidden sites in Iraq. So we're talking about thousands of people, most of them randomly picked up. Only a handful were high value or people who were suspected. Many of them were also relatives or wives or girlfriends of high value prisoners, which again is a contravention of the conventions. So we're talking about thousands of people spread out in Iraq held in detention, many of them civilians. About 90% of them, by the military's own admission, were innocent. And that's only in Iraq. Prior to Abu Ghraib, the revelations about Abu Ghraib, prior to that, we knew that there was torture going on in Bagram in Afghanistan. We knew that thousands, actually, of people were under the supervision of Americans, taken in a metal truck in scorching heat and executed in Afghanistan. We know that people were hung from meat hooks. We know there was a kind of a vigilante CIA or ex-paramilitary, an American, who claimed that he was doing this under with government knowledge, with U.S. government knowledge, who was out there actually torturing, admittedly torturing, by physical torture of the most extreme kinds. So we know Afghanistan was also a center of torture. We know in Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, there was torture going on. The ACLU filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the government a year ago, and they finally got, after a lot of stonewalling, they finally got the material. It's on their website. You can see the memos and what kind of things were going on. The government cannot say that these were some incompetent, stupid, perverted trailer trash somewhere doing this. And you know what a racist and class-based attack that was. Whatever we say about Lindy England or Charles Grainer or all the other reservists who were thrown into prison finally, Grainer finally got 8 years in prison. I'm not saying that what they did was correct. They were the least culpable in the chain. They were the least culpable. We can at least say that they were guards. They were subject to all the pressures of being guards of unruly masses of people. They were subject to all the vile conditions of Abu Ghraib, and descriptions of Abu Ghraib show that it was a vile place. It was constantly subjected to barrage and mortar attacks. The food was dreadful. There were droppings, insects, droppings in the food. People were constantly suffering from diarrhea, walking around in their feces, rain. It was a dreadful place. So at least the guards lived there and have some kind of excuse for their behavior. Yet they get 8 years, they're tossed out, they're condemned. And nothing happens to the people at the top. But we can say for certain from the ACLU Freedom of Information Act request and the information that came out of it, we can say clearly from it that the policy of Abu Ghraib, the acts at Abu Ghraib were not committed solely by reservists. They were committed by some of the cream of U.S. forces, by Delta forces, by SEALs, by Navy SEALs, by Marines. And it's clearly in the records. And the kinds of acts that were committed include things like executions, mock executions, pouring inflammable things on the skin and setting fire, breaking limbs, kicking in the head, smashing against the wall, asphyxiation, drowning, serious matters, sodomy, abuse and rape of children. That was mentioned by Seymour Hersh at an ACLU meeting. The video of there's an audio file of his speech that's available on the net. That was never taken up by the media. To this day, that has not been discussed, even though those reports are in foreign newspapers. The children as young as 8 were held in some of the camps. Another explosive story that has never been covered or pursued. The complicity of medical personnel. This was commented on by bioethicists in The Lancet. It was never followed up. I think that was that report came out in August 2004. I might be wrong, but I think it was last year. Still, no follow-up. These are very, very serious facts. Medical personnel were involved in designing some of the experiments or some of the interrogation incidents of torture. Medical personnel were involved in showing prisoner files to the interrogators so that the interrogators could adapt their techniques to the prisoner's physical health. medical personnel revived prisoners enough in order to torture them again. There is no other way to say this except that these resemble Nazi techniques. And indeed, when you go back in the history of the CIA, from whom did the CIA learn some of these techniques? As you know, the CIA comes out of the OSS, which was formed during the Second World War, and post-Second World War, indeed, these techniques were learned. There was collaboration with the Nazis in learning some of these techniques. That sounds sensational, that sounds like an exaggeration, but it is documented history. So when we see that these most egregious parts of the torture scandal have not to date been pursued in the major media, we have to ask why. Why do we focus on this, naked pyramids of men? Why do we focus on panties? Why do we focus on the less egregious incidents? So that we can give the appearance of revealing, so we can give the appearance of clearing up the scandal and actually do nothing. Why is it that we can talk about trailer trash doing this in a very racist, in a very bigoted fashion, a fashion bigoted against the weakest and poorest class of people, but we cannot ask about the complicity of Donald Rumsfeld, of Stephen Gomboni, the complicity of Paul Wolfowitz, and even of President Bush? Among the ACLU documents are two memos. Again, I've not seen these discussed in any place in the New York Times or in the Washington Post to date. One of the memos is by Paul Wolfowitz. It's on the web. You can see it on the ACLU site. Wolfowitz is requesting that the interrogations be done, interrogators masquerade while they're interrogating as FBI agents. Now, what would be the purpose of that? The purpose would be deniability, plausible deniability. In other words, if somebody complains about it, we can then blame another government agency. And we can distract and move attention away from the CIA and the paramilitary, where the real problem is, to some other branch of government. The FBI actually come off as somewhat the good guys in the whole situation. These are records from Guantanamo, by the way. The FBI, there are complaints made, and people are told to shut up and keep quiet about it. And that's documented as well. Also documented is a reference to a memo by President Bush, apparently an executive order or a memo, apparently authorizing some of the practices. That's not referred to in major newspaper accounts. What is referred to is Rumsfeld's involvement. But even there, Rumsfeld's connection to, for instance, the practice of using dogs against prisoners is underplayed. And if you look at the kinds of torture techniques used, you know that these were developed very specifically as a policy. No young reservist could possibly have the imagination to come up with terrorizing Arabs with dogs. That would require a knowledge of culture, a foreign culture, because it's known that among Arabs, dogs are frequently considered creatures, unhygienic and bad luck, bad spirits, not allowed into the house. So it would be particularly offensive to use a dog. And the dogs were used not just to threaten. The dogs actually bit prisoners. There are pictures of prisoners bitten with dogs. Using sexual assault, including assault by females of the male prisoners, fondling and actually hurting them in the genital area, sodomy, smearing what apparently was menstrual blood on them. The extreme. These are imaginative techniques that could not have been developed by some young American from the rural area. It could not have been. So obviously a policy. We know there was a book, Raphael Patai's book, The Arab Mind, which specifically said that the way to control and humiliate Arabs was through sexual trauma. We know that book was used in intelligence training, even though it's scorned in academia. So when we have all these bits and pieces and it's not assembled into a clear picture of what this torture is about, then what we have in practice is ideology. We have self-censorship. And self-censorship comes partly because of lack of knowledge, but also is an unwillingness to believe that this is what our government can do. We are unwilling to believe that our army can rape or do any of these things. We are unwilling to accept that an empire can act in any other way. But in fact, empires have always behaved like this. There is nothing unusual about American torture. It's precisely what all empires do. The French Empire did it. The British Empire did it. The Mughal Empire tortured. Hindu Empire tortured. Torture goes with a very large, dominating state apparatus. It's the way people are controlled. It's the drive for information which always leads to torture. And that is why this recent story about the government spying and President Bush's order of in 2002, they've been surveilling all our email and our phones and all that without a warrant, a remarkable admission. That is not unconnected to torture. When the government wants to get into your head so badly, you know for a fact that at some point it will use whatever means it can to get into your head, and that means it's torture. So that is the extent of, and that is the meaning of torture in the empire today. It is not something, it's not a random sideshow. It's intrinsic. It's part of a sustained effort to gain control over populations. And initially that effort is directed against foreign populations, against enemy populations. But as this latest revelation about surveillance tells you, all these methods are practiced abroad and then brought home. And that's why the dismantling of American civil liberties today is the most crucial thing happening in politics, and why the public should be outraged and be demanding to know what is taking place. From the floating of the Matrix, from the Patriot Act 1, the provisions of Patriot Act 2, which was snuck in and passed without any kind of outcry. What we have now is the emergence of a police state. It does not appear to us to be that, because we walk around in relative freedom. I'm allowed to get up and talk and people are photographing it. How can there be a police state? Well, it's a nice gilded police state. It's a police state, a very clever one, which allows you to say certain things and go so far. But should you show up at an anti-recruitment drive and try to actually do something, then the police state shows its fangs against its own, not against Iraqis, foreigners, Swahili, Arab males on planes, not against them, but on nice Catholic girls of 24, my roommate in Pittsburgh, who was protesting at Pittsburgh, a scholar of medieval theology. She and other nonviolent citizens were peacefully demonstrating. Dogs were turned on them. An 80-plus woman was bitten. Tasers were used. Nonviolent technology, we are told. Nonviolent, non-lethal. Well, I'll tell you this. If you shoot a plastic bullet into an eye, it's pretty lethal. It's pretty lethal. Some of those weaponry can kill just as surely as a bullet, a regular bullet. And the trouble with these non-lethal weapons and these no-touch torture is that when they are used, people will close their eyes to it and say, well, they're not that bad. And that is the use of those terms. Those terms are propaganda terms. We have to be very clear about them. They're propaganda terms. They allow the government to do things that would otherwise be impermissible. And this, the element of Abu Ghraib that is most relevant to the American population to know is this, that these technologies and techniques which are being used abroad in detention camps are corrupting, polluting, and poisoning civilian life here, not only with the dismantling of civil liberties, but with also the intrusion of military tactics increasingly into civilian functions, civilian fields. You saw Katrina. You saw the flood in the floods in Katrina. You saw the behavior of the feds after that. You saw armed police, like a military-style intervention. That's not unique. Recently, in the last week or so, you all heard of the shooting of Rigoberto Alpaizar in Florida, a Hispanic man, a citizen actually, for 20 years, who had not taken his medication on a plane. Now, he was already making somewhat of a commotion in the terminal. Nobody stopped him at that point. He got on, went on to the plane. His wife explained to the passengers around, the pilot knew that this man had not taken his medication. At some point, he jumped out of his seat and ran off the plane. Undercover federal marshals, air marshals, followed him. They claimed that he made a threat about a bomb. Nobody else heard this threat. They shot him and killed him. Now, when I wrote an article about this, I was amazed at the kind of response I got. Knowledgeable people, people who had been involved or knew something about the police brutality, especially against the mentally ill, wrote to support me. Police, ex-police officers who knew the training methods that are sometimes used in police departments wrote to support me and said, indeed, the militarization of the police is something to be afraid of. But I was overwhelmed by ordinary citizens who thought that was just fine and they wanted themselves protected in that manner. They failed to ask why the man was ever allowed onto the plane, And if the federal marshals undercover Newsom, after all, they have digital surveillance and they are undercover and that is their job. If they had fallen down on the job at that point, why did they then shoot later when the man was running off the plane? These sorts of questions seem weak-minded, bleeding-heart sorts of questions. They are not. They're intensely relevant. Can the government be allowed to ride so roughshod over human beings, its own citizens, that it shoots at sight on such slight suspicion and then covers up its act with a hardly believable story about a bomb? There are many other methods that could have been used to shoot and kill immediately. That bespeaks the entry of military tactics into civilian control. And that is the real story of where Abu Ghraib will lead us. And that is the real danger at present in America today. Thank you.
I was learning something about what happened in El Salvador and Guatemala, and I got to thinking eventually that torture was not to derive information like as a schoolboy I figured it was. Torture was used before execution by the militaries down there in order to suppress the civilian population.
Yes, indeed, I agree with that. Intimidation is really the use of it, but the excuse is the using information. In this conjunction, I did not mention something which I think is very relevant. In the 90s, under the Clinton-Gore Reinvent Government Initiative, a lot of government jobs were cut, including spook jobs. That was about the time of the end of the Cold War. A lot of Kremlinologists were out of work. A lot of spooks were out of work. The CIA was wondering where it was. A bit of a limbo, actually. At that point, this business model was applied to government, and you got a lot of government functions actually contracted out to firms, to private firms. And at that time, some of these out-of-work spooks got hired by private contractors who then turned around and contracted them out to the government. And under the business model, these functions were taken over under the profit motive, so to speak. You had firms like InQtel, which is a venture capitalist firm functioning in Langley. And what that did was it put in place a set of financial incentives. Interrogators were getting paid salaries as high as $400,000 a year, an interrogator with an MBA from Harvard, for instance. Now, when you're paying $200,000, $300,000 a year, you better produce information, right, at whatever cost. And so you go out and you grab the first person. You have to get information to fulfill your quota. And what happens when you can't? Well, then you apply a little arm twisting, because we know that arm twisting does produce information. Only it's not reliable information. It's useless information. But that doesn't matter if all you're looking for is information to fulfill your quota. So we can't overlook the economic incentives that were put into place at that time. And coupled with this new paradigm of laws that were put into place by the Bush administration, I think it became kind of a cancer. And yes, indeed, information is only ostensibly the reason. There's never real information produced because people say anything when they're being tortured. And it turns out to be nothing true, of course, afterward. But it does work. Do one thing. It intimidates people. And that is primarily what it's used for. It was used in Latin America like that. It's being used like that today. Any questions? Yeah.
Yeah. I'm in the middle of your book, and I appreciate the analysis you bring to bear on the American media and how it's the filter through which we understand these things. So I want to make a comment on the American media and then ask you to respond to it and compare the American media to other international media.
Yes.
The same way. It seems that, two words that we rarely ever hear in the American media are Geneva Conventions. And there is always discussion of the political damage or the illegality or legality of things that are going on, including these new secret prisons that are being revealed to be in Europe, things that are going on in Guantanamo Bay, other things, and they're examined by, is this legal, is this a violation of American law? But anything that's a violation of the Geneva Conventions is a violation of American law as well. But it seems that the media, when they're covering these issues, are taking their cues about what is and what is not legal in terms of interpretation, and also what is and what is not acceptable from high government sources instead of from an internal and independent sense of what is right or wrong. Is that unique to the American media, or is that also, do we find that also in other countries?
No, it is unique. It is unique. I mean, that is something that it's hard to grasp, actually. You put your finger right on a very essential thing, which is a lot of what's printed in major newspapers is more like a government press releases than anything else. Reporters are supposed to question what they hear. What they get is from the government, they kind of uncritically print it. And what is they fall down on their duty as the Fourth Estate, because the citizenry need to know the questions behind this, the hard questions. Those are never asked. You talked about the Geneva Conventions and U.S. law. That's one failure. But another failure is also to describe the torture only in terms of violations of the law. And I discuss this in the book. I analyze the media in terms of what I call the pulp drama, which is a kind of a soap opera that is created in the media, and what I call the forensic drama. And both of these are kinds of strategies to obfuscate the issue. The pulp drama is when you focus suddenly on Lindy England, Charles Grainer, make this story out to be a personal story about wrongdoing by an individual. And you get caught up in their personal lives, where they live, their trailer parks, they are beating the wife, whatever they did, Grainer's past history. That's the pulp drama. It's driven partly by the commercial nature of the media. People's attention can't be held, so they have to be held with these sob stories and these personal stories. But what it does is it puts the brain to sleep. You get caught up in a personal story. Abu Ghraib is not a personal story. It's not a story about some individual soldiers doing something wrong. So that's one way of obfuscating. The other way of obfuscating is what I call the forensic drama, in which everything turns into a courtroom battle. And that works well in covering up the wrongdoing at the top. So you have hearings, and you talk, and you say mistakes were made. You know, the active voice gets dropped out, you notice. It isn't Rumsfeld made a mistake, or President Bush made a mistake. It is mistakes got made. That is the nature of bureaucratic language, and Orwell spoke about it. You use that kind of language, and you lose track of who is doing it, that there are people with names, addresses, careers, faces, who are actually doing these things. It just didn't happen by itself. And that's the language in which the media couches criticism of higher officials. And then they have a strategy in which they debate some very arcane torture trail. Who wrote this memo, when, where, when, how? And they draw timelines. And that's wonderful. It has to be done. And legally it has to be established what went wrong. But the public is not going to get interested in Abu Ghraib because of that. In the American public, in the general, in the mainstream, and I listen to a lot of talk radio, I have heard more Gordon Liddy, Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, and all of them than I care to think of. And I enjoy doing it because I have my pulse on what the audience that they have think. And I can tell you this, they think nothing about the law. If you tell them the Supreme Court doesn't like this, they're for it. For them, the Supreme Court is the enemy for a large part of the population. They are a bunch of elitists from elite schools who look down their nose at the red state population and want to legislate things in that they can't win politically. That is what the mainstream, the audience for, let's say, the conservative shows think. So there's no point trying to get people's attention by telling them this is against the law. They love that. They love that our government can thumb its nose at international law, at those wizards in France and Europe, those hypocrites who would do what we do, only they don't have the guts to. So using that kind of strategy to get the public interested will never work, and hasn't worked. People said ho-hum when they heard about the Biden memo. When they heard that Alberto Gonzalez had written this, they confirmed him anyway, right? So obviously it doesn't work. Using that strategy, that is necessary for legal scholars to know how the responsibility and where the responsibility lies. But for the public to get outraged, you have to let them know why detention and torture of citizenry abroad, because it's not only terror suspects, this is not only Al-Qaeda members who are tortured. You have to show them that citizens abroad, civilians abroad, are being tortured in a manner incompatible with U.S. law, against our own tradition. Forget international law. The American public is not that interested in international law at all. It's the contravention of our own constitutional history. And there's a reason why we have these constitutional protections, because without that, without those civil liberties, there is no way that we can stop a headlong descent into a police state. If it's framed in those terms, if it's framed in terms that we are losing our freedoms here, it's framed in terms of this is big government, big brother spying on you and coming for you next, then indeed the public will understand what Abu Ghraib is all about. I'll bet you that. If we are told the secret history of US foreign policy, not the mythology. The mythology is that we are always intervening everywhere for democracy, freedom, and human rights. And occasionally we make mistakes, too bad, but other people do much worse. If we break and shatter that mythology, if the journalists do their job and break that mythology and show that indeed CIA operations have largely produced many of those brutal dictators that we are so upset with, and that most of what these covert operations are all about is the interests of corporations, not of legitimate national security or anything like that. Corporate interests that are as much opposed to the interests of the American people. When we make that case, then I'll bet you the red state, the right wing, the libertarians, the angry white males who listen to Sean Hannity will be converted. They will know where the danger lies. But we're not making the case in the right way. We're not arguing from our own constitutional history and our own laws and our own ideals. Instead, we're talking in terms of international law, the Europeans, what the Europeans think. Well, we really shouldn't care what the Europeans think or that. We need to care about what are happening to our own institutions by what we are doing.
I think I'm a little pessimistic about this American public trying to change things by voting. I talk lots of people around work and anywhere else, and your average Democrat or Republicans, they don't care about their civil liberties, they don't care about
civilians. I would disagree with you. It depends on how it's framed.
Yeah, but a very small group of people do, but average person doesn't care. I really wonder what Americans think about and why don't they care.
Okay, I'll accept that it's at now, for instance, if you go to the websites where there is talk about the police state and about the loss of civil liberties, you will find a site called Anti-War, for instance, which is basically a libertarian right-wing site, yet they are very close and they often exchange articles with less left-wing sites. So there is understanding on both sides of the political spectrum. And I don't want to call this extreme, because that's a word that pro-war people like to use to demonize others. I think there is a chance to make alliances here with all sorts of untraditional groups, like non-traditional allies of, say, the left or the progressive groups. But I also want to say that we should not be too pessimistic about our chances of changing the public's mind. The public is subjected to a barrage of propaganda. As I said, the talk radio goes on 24 hours a day. There's never a moment when there isn't a right-wing talk radio show going on. 2 hours at a time, poisoning people's mind, giving them a perverse picture of things. Now, often saying things that need to be said as well. I'll say that. Often breaking the silence on certain subjects, talking about it, perhaps not in a way that I would approve of, but certainly bringing to light certain things that need to be said in this country. But at the same time, talking in a very inflammatory manner. So people are being subjected to that. It's not that the public would not understand if they were not subjected to that propaganda. So we have to make an effort to hold out a hand, to understand that the population is propagandized, to reach them where they can be reached, and make some alliances and not be pessimistic that they would not appreciate what is happening.
I'd like to ask you to go in a little more depth into your analysis of the language of criminality and the language of the courtroom as one way of understanding or misunderstanding what the phenomena that you've been describing. What puzzles me about what I hear you saying about that is that you appear to be estimating that it's not going to be very productive for someone who wants to see human rights abuses controlled to portray those abuses as crimes. And I'm it seems to me that I don't understand why you appear to be saying that criminal portrayal of an abuse is destined to limit the scope of the responsibility to those at the lowest levels. Because as I understand the language of criminality, it involves crimes that absolutely nobody is immune from potential prosecution for, all the way up to heads of state. And the what's particularly interesting to me about the criminal view of abuses is that you just demonstrated, or at least made a powerful plea for the case, that you can't rely on journalists and you can't rely on public opinion to notice and understand and condemn and intervene and demand action to oppose every abuse that comes along in time to prevent it from claiming hundreds of thousands of victims. So if you can't, then what could you rely on? And one possible alternative is a criminal justice system that has the authority to act worldwide and to do so against any government that is perpetrating abuse. And if you don't create a at least a discussion about that possible attempt to take the crimes against humanity that exist on the books and turn them into and treat them the way we normally treat crimes of all other kinds, then you may be missing an opportunity to do something effective and rely only on public opinion and journalistic intervention, which isn't.
Yes, it's a good point, and I'm sorry if I came across as suggesting that I'm not in favor of legal intervention. I am. It's not that I hope I didn't give the wrong impression there. I do want the legal pursuit of these cases, definitely. All by all means, if we can put Rumsfeld or anybody else on the dock, I would love to see it. I'll be there cheering. I would love to see it. Unfortunately, I think I'm pragmatic enough to know that in most of these cases that does not take place. Therefore, framing the argument solely in those terms is what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about people not pursuing that. Yes, indeed, it's an outrage that laws were changed, circumvented, or actually dismantled. That's a crying outrage. It needs to be addressed. What I'm talking about is how do we frame the argument to get the most traction with the American public? Because until we get that traction, we won't have allies strong enough to put an end to what's happening. And we can't get it by solely relying on the legal argument, because for a large part of the population, the law is discredited in that sense, particularly international law. That is seen as a violation and an infringement of American sovereignty. And the reason they feel that that's the way it's seen is because there has been, since the 80s, a very sustained grassroots conservative movement that has made certain that people think that way. Federalist Society, for instance, from which a number of the Bush administration appointees and legal scholars are drawn, a number of them, the Federalist Society, a right-wing group, particularly wants to attack the law in the U.S. as the instrument which is sort of forcibly pushed through a number of legislative initiatives, kind of politicized a large number of areas, and done things that it could not have done politically. In other words, when you don't have the people behind you on an issue, whether it's abortion or equal rights or anything else, you go to the law and you get that done. And that has enraged a number of people. That has enraged people. People feel that that's somehow an elitist rewriting of the culture of this country. And the Federalist Society is dedicated to roll back those kinds of legal initiatives. So the lawyers in the Bush administration, being drawn from that, are intrinsically opposed to things like international law. So therefore you have a guy like John Bolton being sent to the UN. Well, why would you send someone to an institution he doesn't believe in, which he thinks should, you know, he famously said that if the UN lost 10 stories, it wouldn't matter. Whatever he said exactly, I'm not sure. But that's the kind of attitude. They really do not believe in international law at all, and their followers and supporters do not either. So appealing to them using that rhetoric will not work. I'm talking here solely about rhetoric. I'm not saying that we need to dismantle or ignore legal strategies. Coming to what you said about we don't have any alternatives behind except major media and legal intervention, yes, we do. We have a huge groundswell of public opinion and citizen activism, citizen journalism and alternative journalism and web blogging and internet activity, which is actually holding the major media to account. I'll give you an example. The recent story of torture flights, what's called air torture, moving prisoners around in Europe, has been kept alive since 2001 by citizen activists. People, for instance, I'll give you an example in Shannon, Ireland, which is one of Shannon Airport, is where the CIA jets refuel on their way to Europe. And activists there have been spotting them, you know, they call it plane spotters. They watch these planes, they take down the numbers, they go through the logs, they correlate the logs with the arrest of certain people, and they pretty much systematically created a database which proves or documents the movement of these planes and the movement of these prisoners. And they have persistently brought this issue up when the government has been ignoring them, when the major media has been ignoring the story, and at last it has surfaced. So that is what I'm talking about, the pressure of the citizenry itself, writing, talking. It's come to the point, for instance, the white phosphorus, the admission by the government that white phosphorus was used in Fallujah, something they denied for a year. They outright flat lied about it. How did that actually come out? A blogger, bloggers in America, bloggers in Britain, went through military records and showed that the military itself had admitted the use of white phosphorus. And when that turned up on the internet, it turned up in the mainstream media. The mainstream media actually followed the internet. We can make the mainstream media irrelevant. We can make it so that they are watching us. We don't have to watch them at all. The movement is now coming from the grassroots, from the net. And that's why it's also important that we are aware of the government's surveillance, because if the net is controlled, then indeed we have lost a voice. And therefore, that's why email surveillance, warrantless surveillance, these attacks on cyber attacks on the net are very, very dangerous things that the public should be aware of, because that's the last remaining voice of the public. And that indeed is where I think pressure can be applied to the government and is being applied. It's through the internet and through activists, indie media all over the country, in fact, that the roots of the CIA jets have been revealed. We know now that they start from North Carolina. We know that they go to Langley, pick up a few operatives there. We know they go to Dulles. We know then they fly to Europe, stopping in Shannon. They go to major airports all over Europe. We know they pick up prisoners who are rendered by European intelligence agencies to the CIA. We know from there that they go all over the world. They go to Morocco, to Jordan, to Syria, to Egypt. And that's not all. That's what we are admitting, we are hearing about now. We've heard about Romania and Poland as also places where there could be black sites. But it's highly likely that the real sites are not even being discussed. My own suspicion is that Uzbekistan is one such site. We know that the British ambassador to Uzbekistan, Craig Murray, was in the news earlier this year, resigned and left his job because he had made a criticism about the British government's toleration of abuse and complicity in torture in Uzbekistan. And if you want to know what kind of torture, torture including murder, mutilation, immersion in boiling liquid. Craig Murray complained about it and then left the service. And he also observed that CIA planes, American planes, were regular, frequent visitors to Uzbekistan. So I'm pretty certain that that was one of the destinations of the torture jet. And this is Hamid Karzai is frequently criticized by our own State Department for these human rights abuses, at the same time that we are complicit with him. We're talking about other possible sites, let's say Diego Garcia. The government has denied that vigorously, but why should we believe the government? It's denied everything else. Diego Garcia, in the Indian Ocean outside India, is another likely site. We're also told that there are sites on ships. We don't know where, God forsaken, you know, some place out in the ocean, location unknown. There must be numerous sites like that. Indonesia, there's another possibility. Recently, we've heard in November, President Bush has entered into full military cooperation with Indonesia, including counter-terrorist support. The U.S. government the tsunami earlier in the last year gave plenty of cover for U.S. military and spy satellites and so on to enter Indonesia, whereas formerly they could not. So when we're talking about these torture camps, detention, torture jets, and so on, we're talking about a worldwide network. Let's not be mistaken about it. It's highly unlikely that what we hear in the press is complete and exhaustive. The chances are that that's there's much more. Yes?
If we're to depend on the internet for our information, it seems to me that anybody can write anything on the internet, so how do we know what to believe?
Yes, they can. But they can also write anything in the New York Times, as we have found out. In fact, they wrote a lot of anything, and they were given Pulitzer Prizes. The internet, at least, we can go there alert and aware, and we can cross-reference. There are left-wing bloggers, there are right-wing bloggers, they're always calling each other. So there is a question of reliability. But let me tell you, there is even more unreliability in mainstream accounts, far more. And they're given the imprimatur of respectability, so your guard is down and you believe it. And you have this objective, pompous, neutral tone, as though not one bit of subjectivity is involved. And you know that all these people are friends with each other. They all go to dinner with each other. They're all in each other's pockets. They're friendly with the sources in government. They wouldn't say anything to offend. They're out for prizes that they can only win by cooking up scandals of various sorts. All that is involved. They're celebrity journalists. They're the court press. There's very little of the old-fashioned, down in the, you know, get down dirty, dig up the dirt kind of journalism going on, except in smaller newspapers. I'll tell you that the rape story, for instance, the story about the rape of a child, of a young boy, was not mentioned at all in the major newspapers. It was mentioned, I think, only in the Detroit Free Press, and it was kind of buried in the story. There were two stories. One was about the rape of American service women by service men, and the service women, of course, ignored. That was one story. And the other was the rape of a teenage boy. And that was never followed up on, and that was never mentioned, and still isn't mentioned. And neither is the story about the complicity of medical professionals. So how reliable is the mainstream journalism? It's all very well to put down unimportant things in a very detailed, serious fashion, and then eliminate or just ignore the more important things. That's also a form of censorship, isn't it? Censorship is not merely suppressing something, it's also ignoring it, distorting it, placing it in the wrong perspective, immersing it in public relations. So yes, the internet, there's plenty of unreliable, wrong information. But in the internet, wrong information is usually swiftly corrected by other bloggers who will write and post and say, no, you don't know what you're talking about. There's correction. And if you follow it systematically, you pretty much get an idea of who is fairly reliable and who is not. And in any case, if someone is not reliable, there are hundreds of other people to criticize it. And they also do not speak with the Olympian certainty on all subjects, as the mainstream media does. You are free to disagree. You are free to check the facts for yourself. And when I talk about the internet, I'm not talking about just reading opinion on the internet. You can go into military documents. If you wish to study the CIA history, go and read the CIA's own documents. The Covert Counter-Terrorist Manual is right out there with the no-touch torture techniques, description of photographing of nude detainees, use of dogs, the OSS and post-OSS documentation of research into torture techniques is there. The findings of the President's Committee on Radiation, the radiation hearings under Clinton, which talks about mental trauma, abuse, use of LSD and sexual trauma by the CIA, that's on the internet. Those are documented hearings in front of the Congress. So you do not have to go to secondary sources. You can go to the primary sources and look. You can go to the Defense Department website and check out what the Defense Department is saying. The information about white phosphorus was from the military's own records. The information about the use of thermobaric weapons was also from the military's own records. The information about the torture manuals is from the CIA's own records. You can go to foreign papers of record and see what they are saying and compare it and ask why all the major foreign newspapers are roughly in accord, but the American newspapers are sticking out like a sore thumb, not mentioning any of those things. And you have to then draw your own conclusions about that. I'm not telling you what conclusions to draw. I'm just saying go to the documents themselves and draw your own history and don't let it be told to you by what passes for journalism in this country. Yes.
I'm trying to figure out the argument to use against them, to bring people into caring. You talk about the abuse of somebody who's, to them, a minority. They don't care. And you talk about billions of dollars or trillions of dollars, they don't get their head around it. You talk about surveillance. And unless you take money out of their wallet or lock up their next door neighbor, they're not, the mainstream is not going to care.
Well, you just brought up a good point. Money is going out of your wallet. If you want to have a good look at what's happened where it hits the American consumer, take a look at the debt. Take a look at the deficit. Take a look at record foreclosures all over the country.
It's too big. They the abuses are too much. They don't want to hear about it. It hurts. And so they're like, okay, I'm going to watch Survivor instead.
Yeah, well, there is a degree to which this country has been subjected to so much propaganda, not just overt propaganda. We are like fish swimming in a sea, and the sea is corporate. Not just news media, corporate advertising, corporate everything. We are surrounded by television, press releases, entertainment, everything that is a distraction and a manipulation of us at some subliminal level, which doesn't encourage critical thinking. So yes, we are fighting against that.
Well, how do we bring them? I was hoping you would have an idea of something to talk to them about they could get their head around or care about.
Financial corruption does get a response when I talk about it, even from right-wingers. I have many close friends who are very right-wing. I encourage you to make friends with people who think exactly the opposite of you, getting into rousing arguments with them, because that's the only way you understand and stop preaching just to the converted. And I think the financial argument does affect a lot of people, a lot of conservatives. We're not talking about right-wing libertarians. We're talking about traditionalists and conservatives who may even have been pro-war are worrying about the hemorrhaging of the American economy. They are worrying about the kinds of corruption that we have seen in Iraq, the kind of looting of the treasury, Iraqi treasury and ours. Blatant corruption. I don't think people are happy with that. They might be following along. I don't think they're happy. They are not happy with the effect on American businesses everywhere. The anti-Americanism that has arisen all over the globe as a result of this. We went from having a lot of sympathy. Everyone was an American in after 9/11. We've gone from that to being almost like a pariah state. That business people are worried about.
But houses are still cheap and Walmart's still selling things. I don't see how they're feeling.
Gold is up. Why is gold up? Because people are worried.
The guys at work don't care about gold.
I do think
I understand what you're saying, but I'm looking for an argument. Maybe somebody else has to bring them in. I've yet to find.
But I'll suggest. I'm not saying that immediately people are going to be responsive. I think we should start with civil liberties and loss of freedoms, because this country, the rhetoric of this country is about freedom and liberty. That's one. I do think the business of America is business. How has this affected business and the economy negatively is a good argument, too. I admit that talking about minorities getting locked up in a faraway country in a war on terror is not going to get you very far with the mainstream. We have to talk about surveillance of citizens here. Yes, I think that does make it affect people. Okay. One last question. Yes.
Just in response to your question, because I ask myself that a lot, and one thing I find with the women I work with who really don't seem to pay much attention to the war, when I say, how old is your son, and how do you feel about the possibility of a draft coming in? What would your thoughts be about that? All of a sudden, you get this reframing. And, I've been surprised at how many women say things like, well, I pack them in the car and head for the border. I understand what you're saying. To personalize it for people in a way that it really speaks to them is really important.
So. Yeah, that's an excellent point. That's why Cindy Sheehan made such an impact on people.
So let's talk to them from now on.
Hey, all right.
Okay, well, we'll wrap it up here. Thank you all. I enjoyed talking to you.